guys, welcome back to another week of Autastic. This is your comedian's guide to autism. I'm here every week. I'm one of the hosts. And there's two of us. My name is Kirk, and here's my co-host.
I just let you out to dry there.
That sounds about right.
For a brief moment, I just wanted there for a brief moment for there to be like a new listener, and this is the first episode, and they think you're just criminally insane. You're just talking
ranting
to yourself into a microphone. And I have an imaginary friend named Graham K. But yeah, this is the Comedian's Guide to Autism. We're not scientists trying to figure it out. That was a weird noise I just made. I just want to say, like, this is a special episode. We're not going to do a week in review. We're not going to do it in the news. We have an interview. And do you want to set that up, Kirk?
Yeah. We have a roving reporter named Jill Escher, as longtime listeners know. And she sends us from time to time. She sends us these interviews. So this is a series of interviews that she did at the International Society for Autism Research. And this is one of the seven. And we're down to the last. I think this is number five. Number five we've got here. And this is Alan Brown, who's a medical doctor and an MPH at Columbia University. Your neck of the woods, Graham, out in New York City. And he provides some highlights of the conference. I want to talk about this. I don't know why we're doing weird pauses on this one. I want to talk about this, but I think we should play the interview first.
Yeah, of course.
Okay, you're not saying anything, so I didn't know if, if you could hear me. I feel like Graham is trying to punk me today.
Oh, are we recording right now? No, I'm kidding, man. No, listen, I thought you just set it up, and I thought you pressed play.
I thought you
just set it up on the pod.
Got it. It's set up. Here, let's run it.
Hey, everyone. Roving reporter Jill Escher here reporting at the very tail end of INSAR, the International Society for Autism Research Conference in Montreal, Canada. And I am sitting with Dr. Alan Brown of Columbia University. Hey, Dr. Brown.
Hello, Jill.
Dr. Brown has been on the Autastic podcast before. We were talking about something called epidemiology, because Dr. Brown is an epidemiologist. Can you remind people what that is?
Epidemiology is the study of risk factors in populations, as well as studying the prevalences, the frequencies in which autism occurs in different populations. It makes comparisons.
And Dr. Brown, like 2,000 other researchers, was here to listen to other people's presentations about their scientific work and learn about new findings in the research. And this was a big, sprawling meeting covering countless topics, everything from diagnosis to therapeutics to epidemiology to genetics and many things in between. So Dr. Brown, what were some of the highlights and takeaways of the conference for you?
Well, sure. So, well, first I wanted to talk a little bit about some of the epidemiology. So what's been happening in autism research is that investigators have become more and more interested in environmental risk factors, and they study them in these big populations where they record the risk factors in the mothers who are pregnant, as well as in their offspring or just after they're born. And they can do various things, looking at certain diagnoses of medical conditions and how they're related to autism in the child, as well as certain biological measurements that were taken in various fluids, like blood samples in moms and in the babies when they're born, to see if that predicts the likelihood that the child will get autism.
And what did you learn, with these presentations?
There was one very interesting poster just presented showing that mothers who have anemia, that is like a low level of hemoglobin in pregnancy, their offspring have an increased risk not only of autism, but also of autism with intellectual disability, of intellectual disability without autism, and a little bit higher risk of attention deficit disorder.
Yeah, I saw that was in a Swedish population.
In a Swedish population. And what's very interesting is about 10 years ago, we found that anemia in pregnancy was related to higher risk of schizophrenia.
Oh, so it seems to be consistent in a way.
It looks like, and one of the themes, general themes to make at the point in this meeting, is that whether people are looking at genes or looking at imaging, brain imaging of certain structures of the brain in people with autism, there seems to be some non-specificity. That is, these risk factors don't only seem to be true for autism, but also for other disorders as well.
Yes, a lot of overlap with depression, ADHD, some with schizophrenia. I've seen that in many presentations. You're right, that seemed to be a very strong theme.
And that's been one of the goals of the NIMH has been to try to
NIMH is the National Institutes for Mental Health.
It's been to see if there, rather than just looking at diagnoses, to look at the biological factors that are related to those diagnoses and see if these risk factors and to see if there are certain measures that are shared between these disorders that may represent targets for treatment that would be more easily addressed by certain treatments.
Did you see any presentations or posters that had any information about treatments that you felt was new and interesting?
Well, I don't think new, but there's been more evidence giving use of I know it's doesn't work for everyone, but some increased evidence of cannabidiol treatment and some improvements in certain symptoms of autism, but certainly not.
Cannabidiol is one of the chemical components of medical cannabis, medical marijuana. So yeah, that is actually one of the hottest topics in autism today, I would say.
Yes. And there was another presentation in that same symposium looking at, I don't recall the name, but it's a drug that blocks vasopressin, which is a hormone that's produced by the body, and that seems to be predictive of some improvements in autism as well. I can get the full name for you later, but
okay. Yeah, I saw one poster about TMS. TMS is transcranial magnetic stimulation, right?
That's right.
And it seemed after about 18 treatments. These are about kind of 20-minute treatments with these, like, electrodes on your head. It did seem to have positive impacts on social behaviors of the autistic subjects. That one was a surprise to me. It's not an intervention I really know anything about, but it seemed to have quite an effect.
Yeah, that intervention has been used for some time now in treating depression. One big advantage of it is that it causes a change in the electrical current in the brain, but without inducing seizures.
Right, and which is what you do in ECT, you're inducing seizures, right?
Mm-hmm, yes.
Yeah. So what's another thing you learned? What else?
So there was an interesting talk looking at brain structure, and it looked at people who have autism, and it looked at people, and what it did is it showed that there are different, this is hard, a little, not as easy to explain without getting too technical, but there, it looked like it wasn't just sort of one pattern that fits all autism. It looks like there are at least 10 different patterns. And some of them are consistent with what are seen in other neurodevelopmental disorders. And then on top of that, they looked at genes, risk factors, genes that have been associated with autism, and found that each gene that they looked at gave a different pattern. So it's suggesting that there isn't only, we talk about autism as if it's one entity, but it looks like it may be divided up into many different entities, each with different kinds of biological pathways and causes. And that, in my opinion, one of the points they made was that maybe there's something still going on in common they can treat. But another possibility is that this may feed into what's been known now as a new field called precision medicine. And it may be that applying precision medicine approaches to autism could help. And
yeah, like, for example, I mean, this is a very rough example, but like with diabetes, you have type 1 diabetes and type 2 diabetes, right? And they have different pathophysiological components that lend themselves to different treatments. So maybe someday we'll have like a type 1 autism, a type 2, a type 3, type 4, or something, whatever the label is, that will lend themselves to more precise forms of interventions.
That's right. And I think that could... is potentially the wave of the future now. And for example, in treating not only diabetes, but also certain cancers, in treating certain types of glaucoma, there's evidence now that one can divide them up based on genetic profiles and also environmental profiles to see biological profiles and to use different treatments based on them.
Okay, so carving up the autisms, you would say, is I saw that theme in several presentations.
Yes, carving it up into different parts.
Okay, just in the interest of time, I want to run through a few of the other things that you, you learned and saw.
Sure. So, well, I wanted to put a plug in for some of our own work as well.
Oh, please do.
So we had a poster a couple of days ago by Dr. Czeslaw Postawa, who works with me as an associate research scientist at Columbia, showing that a longer interpregnancy interval was related not only to autism, which was found previously, but also to attention deficit disorder.
Okay, so break that down. Interpregnancy interval means the time between pregnancies.
Yes.
So a longer interval was associated with increased risk? I thought it was supposed to be a shorter interval.
So in an earlier paper, and that was in our cohort in Finland, both short and long interpregnancy intervals mm-hmm. related to autism. In this poster presented here, Keeley showed that long interpregnancy interval, but not short, was related to higher attention deficit disorder. And long was defined actually as 10 years in between individual pregnancy. So that's the second pregnancy occurring 10 years after the initial pregnancy of an individual who had autism.
Yeah, and you were able to control for the maternal and paternal ages in that?
Yes,
yeah.
We control for maternal, yeah. paternal age and for a variety of other confounding factors.
So that's
interesting because first it shows that this may, again, not be a specific risk factor, and it may point to other risk factors like nutritional factors that could vary across the two different pregnancies or other biological processes that may be associated with delayed
childbearing. Yeah, like the parent is so stressed out by then.
Like certainly.
That onslaught of hormones. Okay, so that's very cool. How about anything else in epidemiology that you saw that you thought was interesting?
There was a poster showing that some of the what are known as metabolomics, so that is, they have ways now. So it's been known, for example, that mothers who are diabetic, their offspring have an increase in risk of getting autism. And now what they're doing is trying to look at specific biological markers of these metabolome. And some have been shown to be related. I don't call the precise ones, but they're in a field now where they can look at, say, 10,000 of these different metabolic markers or indicators. So, for example,
that's a lot of indicators.
Yeah, if you can look at blood glucose and you can look at related factors to that. But the idea now is to see if we can understand more about the biology that may underlie this. So these would be, for example, enzymes that are found in the liver that break things down, other molecules related to kidney function. And, for example, preeclampsia is a condition that involves abnormal functioning of the kidney. And now we're looking at biological markers that are correlated with that to see if they're related to autism. So so this is a big emerging field. One of the tricky things, and we had a whole session really on what's known as machine learning, which is a new method now, a statistical method that looks at multiple where when you have a very large data set, what they call big data, and we're trying to parse out which of the factors are most associated with a particular outcome.
Throw in a whole bunch of data and see what comes out.
And essentially, unlike the way we usually do research, where we hypothesize a particular risk factor that's related and then we test it, this says we give it the data and let the machine tell us. Now, we have to be very careful about that because we're relying upon, a computer program, and sometimes this can spit out data that that may not be replicated. So it's a very new method and one
tool
we have to be careful about. It's a new tool.
Yes, I was at that presentation. It was very complicated. It was a little bit above my head, all that machine stuff. And it's very, very statistically complex.
It's statistically complex and challenging, and it's above the heads even of most epidemiologists.
Oh, good, I wasn't alone.
That's why we had the meeting, so we could all learn more about it and see how we can apply it to our research.
So was there anything at this meeting that you found particularly vexing or difficult or dismaying?
Well, yeah, I don't know that I would say dismaying, but I think now with the emergence of new genetic technologies, they're able to sequence all the genes in individuals. And what gets tricky is that A lot of these, number one, a lot of these genes are very rare in populations. Mm-hmm. And so if they are risk factors for autism and they have shown various associations, they tend only to be present in very small percentages and may not explain a lot of the illness. Another is that they try to group those risk factors into certain biological pathways, but those pathways tend to be very nonspecific as well. So I think we have a big challenge now where we're seeing a lot of hits. The more we look for, the more we find. We find a lot of genes of small effect, and these genes, a lot of them differ a lot in what they do, and a lot of times we don't even know what they do. So I think, one of the biggest challenges, I would say, is that the genetic studies tend not to include any environmental factors.
That's right.
And the environmental studies are trying to include genetic factors, but sample sizes tend to be fairly limited. Mm-hmm. So I think we have this problem where I think it's going to end up probably being some sort of genetic environment interaction, gene interactions between them that will account for a lot of what we see in autism. And what we need are really good samples with data on both.
Well, I was certainly frustrated with the genetics presentations, pretty much for the reasons that you said, because we're pouring people, autistic listeners, we're pouring millions and millions and millions of dollars into genetic research in autism. And they keep saying, oh, we keep finding these autism genes, but that's not really true. What they're finding are very, very, very rare variations that in a few cases confer some percentage of increased risk for autism, or as we saw, other related, developmental disabilities or neuropsychiatric disorders. So, I think there's a lot of overhype. I just saw a lot of overhype in the genetics presentations, and that is what frustrated me the most at the meeting.
Yes, and one thing they need to make clear, I think, is these are really genes for brain maldevelopment.
Yes, they're not really autism genes. One of the slides from one of the presentations said there are no autism genes. There's no such thing as an autism gene. I thought that was the best slide I've ever seen, because it's true.
Yes,
there's no autism genes. There are syndromes that have some autistic traits as a consequence, but so I found that frustrating, but I think you're right. Hopefully we'll do more gene environment work and look more holistically and biologically at risk factors. But we are out of time, Dr. Brown, but I wanted to thank you so much for being back again on Autastic and sharing your observations with us.
Well, thank you so much, Jill. It's my pleasure.
All right, what do you think?
I mean, I thought that was a great interview. One thing I like to do in mid-interview is I like to pretend that it was Fred Arneson speaking. He's got a very similar voice.
That's good. That is true. He does have something similar.
Yeah. Very smart man, very articulate man. And there's a lot of interesting things. I love that Jill did a great job as well in highlighting that there is no autism gene. I think that, we've sort of touched upon that in talking about similar research in the past, that, oh, they're close to finding it, and no, they're not. It is just mental disabilities that they find abnormalities. They don't know what it means, and it can mean anything.
I thought, there's a couple interesting things. I thought it was very interesting that now they're talking about doing a distinction of different kind of autisms, like
she drew
the comparison to diabetes, 1 diabetes, and then he kind of not corrected her, but was like, or we could do like different cancers. And I thought it was interesting where they get rid of Asperger's, which is a clear differentiation, which I think can be kind of useful in the sense that if somebody has Asperger's, they don't have what my son has, where he's smearing poop on the wall when he's 15.
Yes.
So I think there's a clear distinction that is helpful. In language, it's important to be able to communicate, and I feel like being able to communicate the distinction is important. That being said,
I think it's 100% necessary. In fact, in this podcast, we refer to people of having what used to be called Asperger's quite a bit, because we're not Asperger's anymore, but we don't know what to call them, and we are both have people in our family who are way, way less functioning than someone with Asperger's.
And honestly, I think, let's say Asperger's is a 1, and then JJ is a 10, and I think Peter's probably somewhere in the middle. Because, I mean, Peter still has jobs. My sons have a job. Peter still can live alone. He can still cook things for himself.
Peter does have, Peter does have jobs, but it's more charity than jobs. He doesn't really do anything, and he gets
fired a lot. But I mean, I'm not diminishing my son as a human being, but my son is not there where he has the ability to even understand. You need to be there at this time. He can't tell time. He can't ride the bus alone. He can't. He can barely dress himself. He doesn't understand that he can't get naked in public half the time. So, and again, this isn't to disparage my son. This is to point out that there are clear distinctions between where Peter's at and where my son's at. And I think some sort of scale would be helpful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Absolutely. And I think that this is sort of, it's funny that they were saying that, and anyone who's lived with autism or knows people with autism knows that there is like different, there already, whether we want to label it or not, there are different types of people with autism. Like,
exactly.
Yeah. Okay. Great. Well, prove it in science, but we all know it is. There is. And eventually they're going to have different names for the different strands, if you want to say, and it'll be traced to
vastly different symptoms. And it's just shorthand as ability to say, instead of saying, what kind is he verbal? No. Does he do this? No. Does he like to masturbate in public? Yes. So instead of saying all those questions, you'd be like, so on the scale, is he like a 3 or like a 1 or yeah.
Yeah. But one thing that we can take away from this that is sort of tangible and listening to this interview is that we now know that if the woman is anemic during pregnancy, there is a higher chance that they will have autism as well as a host of other things like schizophrenia.
I wrote that down too. I thought that was very interesting.
Yeah. Also, if you plan on having more than one kid, try not to have Irish twins, but also try not to wait 4 years in between.
Well, the gap. Yeah, they said the 10 years was very interesting. Yeah.
Yeah.
I thought it was the other way, but.
But they're saying it was both. They're saying it was both. It's just. I wish that they went into more detail on that when the specific window is, but basically they're saying. The newer research is saying don't wait a long time. Well, you guys just listen to the research. You don't need me to say that. But yeah, so I just think there's a lot of interesting things that came out of that. And I thought
it touched on diabetes, which we've mentioned a few times, but that also is a factor for autism.
Yeah,
that's not anything we don't know. But I thought it was interesting.
I thought it was interesting.
This is kind of a shorter one, guys. We just wanted to get this out to you. This is Jill did this interview some time ago, and we're just getting to it. We like to space these out, and it's probably my fault we spaced it out a little too far, but still very relevant and interesting. Send us your notes. We love hearing from you guys. Oh, the other thing I was going to mention was the CBD thing, or the, not CBD, the...
Marijuana.
Yeah.
Cannabis.
Cannabis, yeah.
Both.
The non-high effects of marijuana and its effects on, not available yet where my son's at, but I am interested in that. You know, if you're going to go the route of a mood stabilizer. It's a mood stabilizer that he has. Yeah, I'd be interested in trying some sort of oil or something, some CBD oil or something like that. Yeah.
Have you ever tried it, CBD?
No, I haven't. We talked about this. I think you have, right? You like it?
I've only tried it twice, and one time I didn't really notice it. Maybe I was having a little more of a alert with it day than I normally. Maybe I got a good sleep that it kind of felt like I had a good sleep, I guess is what it made me feel like. My brain was, firing a little better. The other time I did it, I had the worst hangover of my life, and I was staying at a friend's house, and he was like, I have CBD drops. It really helps with my hangovers, and I did it, and it really, really helped within half an hour. Yeah, it was, like, way better. Yeah. Anyway, that's another episode, right? We did it?
We did it, guys. Send us your notes. We love your rates and reviews on Amazon. On Apple or Stitcher.
You're tired.
Or Podbeam. I'm ramping up. I've got a league game tonight in that Comedians and Actors League game. My last league
basketball
game before I'm in New York City. A little basketball,
wow.
Yeah. They're calling in the old man, the old ringer, to come in and bail him out again. You know.
I'm still not back. My broken ankle is still messed since April is when I broke it. It's still not better. And it's what?
Well, if it helps, September. Between the two of us, you look way more athletic. So it's great.
I do.
I look like a Bible salesman who's half Bible salesman, half Muppet.
Not a Muppet. You look like a Bible salesman. Yeah. Full on Bible salesman. Guys, this has been autastic. You can donate to this podcast. We do appreciate the donations very much. You can donate at patreon.com/autastic. Do it. Donate right now. Yes, you listening right now. patreon.com/autastic. Give us a dollar. You listen to us. Why not? Why not? Kirk needs it. Look at him. Look at him on Instagram. He looks like garbage.
Turn.
No, I know. You look good,
buddy.
He's
taking a really weird turn.
Yeah, I know. You look good.
Guys, we appreciate your support. Share this with your friends. Kirk Smith Comedy, all social media platforms. Have a great week, guys. You can do it.